Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Among the beach dirty wannabes of South Beach walked a serial killer, police said, who murdered Gianni Versace on the front steps of his Mediterranean mansion.
Mr. Versace, of course, one of the world's top fashion designers, whose designs are famous in all the big fashion centers such as Paris, Rome, and London.
This was a single white male who approached Mr. Versace as he was about to enter the gates.
Andrew Cunanan is now a target himself. Who is he?
Welcome to Still Watching Versace, a podcast about the FX series American Crime Story, The Assassination of Gianni Versace. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson, and joining me as ever is my co-host and Vanity Fair critic Richard Lawson.
Hello.
Each week we will take a deep dive into the latest episode and talk with some of the stars and creatives behind the scenes. This week we will be discussing Season 2, Episode 1, The Man Who Would Be Vogue, directed by Ryan Murphy, written by Tom Rob Smith. And later in the hour we will be joined by Ricky Martin, who plays Gianni Versace's partner, Antonio D'Amico. But before we get to Ricky Martin, Richard, let's dive right into the episode, shall we?
Yeah, here we go.
Here we go. The episode opens with just a really incredible, largely dialogue-less sequence where we see Versace and Cunanan sort of on a collision course. They showed this sequence over the summer at the Television Critics Association summer press tour, this entire opening. And I was so taken by it that that's when I decided we had to do this podcast.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's the genesis. You know, while I was there, they took us on a tour of the set that they had recreated. They meticulously recreated Versace's bathroom and his bedroom and stuff like that. Those designs were done by production designer Judy Becker, who did like Carol and a lot of like Todd Haynes stuff. She's amazing. And then they also filmed some of this at Versace's real Ocean Drive home, which is now a hotel in Miami. And so it's just like, it's just an incredible, incredible, audacious opening to this. Very stylish. Ryan Murphy pulling out all the directorial stops. What did you think of this opening sequence?
I mean, it certainly is a great introduction to the show's style. And we said last week that in a lot of ways, this show is more of a mood piece maybe than OJ was, which was a little more straightforward. And I think this is a really nice way of setting that tone. And it gives you in just a short amount of time, a real sort of sense of the world, you know, like it's a little bit ornate in a gaudy way, but there's also a sort of passion and an artistry to it. So I don't know. I think it's, you know, as TV gets more and more cinematic, I think we're going to see more stuff like this. So it's exciting.
We haven't talked too much, I think, about the casting in previous episodes, but, you know, here we see Edgar Ramirez as Gianni Versace and Darren Criss as Andrew Cunanan, and Edgar Ramirez looks astonishingly Gianni Versace. I mean, like, you can kind of see it in the genesis of what Ramirez looks like in his everyday, but just the tan and the you know, whiter hair and stuff like that, it's just sort of incredible.
The hair work is amazing. The way that they get the receding hairline just right, like, it's really careful, meticulous work.
Yeah, and then but with Darren Criss, I mean, we'll talk about this actually a little bit later in a different episode maybe, but to be honest with you, Darren Criss is, I think, a little too attractive to play Andrew Cunanan, especially at this point in his life when he had, like, gained a lot of weight and was feeling really insecure about his body, and, like, Darren Criss just looks as beautiful as ever. So that's my only complaint about the Darren Criss casting, which is otherwise, I think, really amazing, because, I mean, obviously we first meet Andrew and he's, like, on a beach and grimy and has this, like, terrible wound on his leg, so he's not, like, looking tip top right in this episode, but still it's a little glam up, I think, for Andrew Cunanan, at least at the end of his life here. So
yeah, I mean, in the crassest possible terms, like, someone as good looking as Darren Criss becomes Darren Criss. They don't probably become a low level hustler, you know what I mean?
Right. Like, right? Yeah, exactly. So, but, and then, you know, of course, there are these little Condé Nast touches that we should mention, which is that Gianni buys the Princess Diana cover of Vanity Fair in this opening sequence, and Andrew is reading The Man Who Would Be Vogue, The Life and Times of Condé Nast in 1982. Biography by Carolyn Siebholm, which gives the episode its title. Andrew Cunanan was sort of very famously obsessed with a variety of Condé Nast publications like Vogue and Vanity Fair. So, you know, it doesn't sound crazy to me that he would be reading this book at the end of it all.
So, Joanna, this is when you were supposed to be like, aha, we have to do this podcast, when you saw the Condé Nast stuff.
And then I said, aha, we have to do this podcast.
To protect the brand.
And there's, you know, there's a lot of really meticulous detail in this opening. You'll see this, I think, throughout the series, that there's a push and pull, as with OJ, with, like, really meticulous detailing of, like, say, what the Versace house looks like, or the pink robe that Versace would wear in the morning, I'm sure, or something like that, versus the other work they have to do of being inside the mind of Andrew Cunanan at the end of his life, when no one knows what was going on. So, like, Darren Criss is Andrew Cunanan wading into the ocean and screaming, that's, you know, by force, like an invention. And that's sort of the poetic license that this show has to take here, and it takes in other places. What do you think of moments like that? And is there a danger? I don't know, danger might be too intense, but is there a danger of people taking this as, like, this is a documentary of what happened with Versace and Cunanan, you know?
I mean, there might be a risk there, because, you know, with OJ, it seemed so kind of verite and you know, like accurate. But, you know, I think that probably people will be watching this in a different way, you know, because, like I said, it's like a mood piece. It's framed differently, you know? And I would say narratively, or as just a viewer, I enjoy this poetic license, you know, because it gives shape and more dimension to the story, that because some of these things are pretty sketchy in terms of what we actually know.
Right.
And so that allows me to kind of ignore the other part of me that's like, well, but if this isn't accurate, how responsible is it to this story that is very fraught, as we'll talk about pretty soon, with a lot of real life things that are in question and still affect people's lives now? And, you know, so I don't know. I'm of two minds about it right now. The half of me that wants to just be entertained is kind of dominant, but we'll see how that goes as the show goes on.
You know, we're recording this a little early, so it's just after the Versace family has made their second, and I think what they claim is their final statement on the show, where they, you know, they directly call out Vanity Fair contributor Maureen Orth, who wrote Vulgar Favors, the book that the show is based on, and they kind of, they call her book sort of based on gossip and not actual journalism. Maureen disagrees, but one major point of there are two major points of contention for the Versace family that we'll talk about a little bit in this episode. One is that Versace, whether or not Versace knew Kunenin, which we'll get into in this episode in great detail, and then whether or not Versace was sick with HIV/AIDS and whether he was HIV positive. And this episode lately touches on that. We'll talk about it more in the future, but we see in this opening scene Versace taking medication.
Yeah.
And prescription medication, and something that Maureen North covers in her book is that he was found with traces of prescription drugs in his bloodstream during the autopsy. So, like, that is a fact. She doesn't detail which prescription drugs.
Right. I mean, some ways you want to be like, He was like this Rococo fashion designer living in Miami Beach. Like, doesn't everyone have prescription drugs in their system?
Like, fair point. This seems to be like, and something that Ryan Murphy said in response to sort of this Versace family concern is that if you believe Maureen North's reporting in her book about Versace's diagnosis, Ryan Murphy's point is like there should be no shame associated with being HIV positive. And so that's kind of his attitude around it. It's a very, I think, compelling conversation to have around what responsibility we have to the secrecy that the family wants versus not shaming something that, I think a lot of people believe to be true. Once again, this is something I think we will talk about a little bit further on in the series, but that's just something I wanted to mention.
Either for better or worse, I'm not really sure. What I think this is kind of nodding to is the fact that in 1997, we were reaching the tail end of a decade where pretty much any gay narrative, be it a play or a book or a movie, it was about HIV and AIDS, in some way had been touched by it. And so I think in a way they're saying, well, this was a part of I don't want to say gay identity, but certainly the perception of gay life by a lot of people in this country and other countries was that HIV or AIDS was always a part of the story. And, maybe it wasn't this, we don't know. But I think that in a sort of more metatextual way, that's kind of what it's doing.
And to what further muddies the conversation around this is the fact that based on some bad information, the media and the authorities immediately jumped on this idea that Andrew Kunenin was HIV positive and that his killing spree was motivated by some sort of like revenge to the men who had possibly infected him. And then it turned out in Kunenin's autopsy that he was not HIV positive.
Yeah.
Whether or not he thought he was, that might be a little bit of a question, but he was not HIV positive and he was assumed to be by so many people, I think, perhaps due to exactly what you're talking about in terms of the gay narratives that cropped up in that decade. And so he was assumed to be but wasn't, and the Versace family is saying Gianni wasn't but maybe he was. So that's like the weird back and forth of this particular medical angle of the case. So.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the few things, that I remember dimly from the case before I dove into doing this podcast and watching the show. I was like, yeah, there was something with HIV, because that I'd like heard that in passing on like A Current Affair, A Hard Copy, or some stupid show I was watching when I was 13.
Were you a huge Hard Copy watcher when you were 13?
I just feel like those shows were always on, Yeah, I guess I was 14 by then, but they were just always on like after school, that's a shame that's the one thing or one of the few things I gleaned from it. But it's also pretty telling, like I said, about a lot of the narratives about gay people that were happening at the time. Not everything was about that if it was about gay people, but like a lot of it was.
Right. So then we cut back in time. So then we get the title, Versace says no. We hear a shot and then we crash to the title card, the assassination of Gianni Versace. And then the show hops back in time. The first couple episodes hop around a little bit in time before the series takes its plan trip sort of more linearly backwards in time.
Yeah.
So these first two episodes, you know, we'll be really conscious to talk about when in time we're talking about in terms of the plot. There are title cards, of course, that are helpful, but
it would be impossible if there weren't, honestly.
Yeah. Who would, like, Johnny Versace's hair is a little darker now. Yeah. Who knows? Okay. So so we flash back to October 1990. It says San Francisco. The title card says San Francisco. This is when Andrew just a little bit after high school was living in Berkeley with his friend Liz Cote, played by Annalee Ashford, and her husband Phil, played by Nico Everswindle. And we see him waking them up to say he met Versace, right? And so this is controversy number two. And we talked about this in our very first episode of this podcast. Andrew Kunanen meet Gianni Versace? Do you have an opinion on this particular subject?
Well, I first want to point out that before he says, "I met Versace," we see him standing creepily over the husband, kind of groping himself, sort of establishing him as this. I mean, we've just seen him shoot somebody, so we know he's a creep, but, like, I don't know. It's just kind of doubling down on that. And I can't really decide if I like that bit of titillation or not, but whatever. Mm. But yeah, I don't, you know, again, having not known really anything about the case, and then watching the episode before I really did any research, I was like, oh, interesting. I guess they knew each other. And then I read and I was like, oh, no, that's very much in contention. I don't know how I feel about it, honestly. I feel like you could tell the story without inventing this thing, although in a sort of very in a blunt way, it establishes Kunanen's kind of values and his aspirational, you know, drive. You know, and also it's just another excuse to have a scene in a gay nightclub. So I don't know. what do you think?
Well, so, you know, Maureen, I talked about this with Maureen in the last episode of this podcast, specifically this, and she has like 9 or more different sources all swearing that Kunanen met Versace, including Liz Cote and her husband, or at least that Andrew came home and bounced on their bed and said, "I met Versace." Like, this exact scene happened to them. But what I think the episode cleverly does upon rewatch is really does potentially make this an invention of Andrew's. Like, this could mm-hmm. be just a story they're telling. Like, when he talks to them further in a later scene in the kitchen, it's very clear that they don't really believe him, but they're like entertained by him anyway. They share these sort of, Liz and her husband share these sort of silent glances of like, oh, here's Andrew spinning another one of his yarns. And that's something that, you know, Maureen's book reiterates over and over and over again, is just that a lot of people in Andrew's life knew he was full of shit, but he was so entertaining that they just kept him around anyway.
Right.
So I think, you know, and Maureen is careful to say that the date aspect, the whole like champagne on the stage of the San Francisco opera scene that happens here, is not something that she has heard anywhere. So that is definitely a show invention. And so,
and there's a dreamlike kind of quality about that bizarre scene where they're just like alone in the opera house, and Versace essentially tells him everything he wants to hear about how he's going to be somebody special and all this stuff. So that very much feels like a fantasy.
Right, exactly. And so it's a very, I think it's a very clever blurring of fantasy and reality here, of like, there's a way in which the show, you know, it, in a court of law, Tom Rob Smith, who wrote, you know, who adapted Maureen's book for this show, could say, well, this was meant to just be sort of in Andrew's head. But like, it's, I don't know, I think it's really beautifully well done. And like, and really, as you say, part of the whole thematic thrust of the show is, you know, the second to last episode of the season is called Creator Destroyer. And this idea of like Versace as a creator and Andrew as a destroyer. And they have this whole conversation about, you know, what does Andrew do? He says like, oh, I'm a novelist. Like, and Versace's like, oh, you're gonna be something great. And he does, of course, become something famous, but for this great act of destruction rather than creation, which we see in comparison to Versace's dressing of the diva and talking about his whole philosophy of creation and all of that. I just think it's, whether or not it actually happened, the way it's done, I think, is kind of vital. It's kind of vital to see these two characters on screen together, even if it is just in Andrew's head.
Right. You know? Yeah. Even if they're just kind of representing opposing ideologies or mindsets, right, or whatever. Yeah. You know, I think you're right.
And we've got this great stuff, this great, really uneasy relationship between Liz and Andrew, where there's obviously a lot of affection there that she has for him, but also flashes of unease, because this is 7 years before he would kill Versace, but he's just always been a charming, engaging person who just oversteps, you know, consistently is the sense. I think Annalee Ashford's performance is really, really good.
Yeah, I mean, she's great and everything, but I don't know, there's something about the way, I don't know if it's Chris's performance or the way that Kunin is written, that I'm not really getting the charm. Maybe it's because I know what he does later, you know?
Yeah.
But like this kind of affected thing, and he's in the kitchen and he's, saying, everything's fabulous, but also saying this homophobic shit to kind of cover up, even though the couple knows clearly that he's gay.
Right.
You know, I don't know. I wonder if maybe part of it is that we're 28 years now removed from when this was. And back then, maybe the tolerance level for this kind of cliche, affected, foppish kind of gay character was sort of more expected and maybe even desired as like a gay friend or whatever. But now, after years of kind of the gay community sort of pushing against that narrative, or at least trying to add some variation into the mix, that sort of stereotype just doesn't sit as, it's just not as charming as it maybe once was. I don't know.
I totally understand that. I don't want to be like, this is a role I play in a lot of podcasts. I don't want to be that person who's like, well, in the book, but well, in the book. And, you know, Maureen North talks a lot about how that is a persona that Andrew adopted, particularly in high school, because it got him attention and he got positive responses to it. Like, people were like, oh, you're so funny and entertaining. And I can totally see how it would grate on anyone who is sort of tired of that being the stereotype, like the birdcage or whatever.
Right.
Like that's all the only option for a gay character at a certain time.
And I certainly have known many gay guys who have done that, some version of that, you know, but I think the difference between them and someone like Kunin, who, you know, clearly had a very, very troubled psychology, is that most people doing that kind of know that it's all bullshit, you know? That's part of the act. It's sort of a wink. It's performance. Whereas you kind of get the impression that Kunin actually believes it and would be kind of shocked to find out that, like, you know, his friends are sort of, you know, smirking behind his back.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so then we flash back to July 1997, the front steps of Versace's house.
Oh, wait. Before we do that, can we go back?
Go ahead.
Is a scene where we see Kunin with, I guess, who's supposed to be a sort of boyfriend. Right? Or is that not yet?
In reality, I think he's just like a friend of his, or was a friend of his. But
okay.
Like a guy who's interested in him.
But so we, you know, that comes before the scene at the opera with Versace and Kunin. But similarly, this kind of just two-hander establishes another sort of relationship thing in the broader show, which is, to my mind anyway, this really, really affecting depiction of queer life as this, as you know, especially back then when people were more closeted, as really lonely, and a lot of people just struggling to find connection. And when they find it, even if it's imperfect, really struggling really hard to hold on to it. And I think that you see that in different ways with Versace and his partner, with characters that we'll see in later episodes. And it adds this really this undercurrent of really kind of pathos that feels really universal and I think grounds the story in something almost relatable, rather than it being this crazy sensationalistic story. So I think that scene is actually pretty crucial, even though it's small.
No, you're right. And you're right. It does offer up like a non-serial killer gay character, which is nice to see. I mean, obviously Johnny Versace is like, and Antonio and their whole world. Like that's a positive depiction of gay life. But, to have, and this idea of, I think what he says is like, I can't get close to you because I don't know who you are. It's just very poignant. I mean, at least on that one side.
Yeah, and he's asking him, like, which lies am I supposed to believe? You know,
right.
like you keep saying you're this, you keep saying you're that. Like, I just want to know which one to kind of go with.
Right.
And he says, you know, I'm not, I know that I'm not, what's the word? It's not exciting. but
something like that.
Something along those lines. He's like, but I'm nice and I'm smart and I'm kind. Yeah. And it's just, ugh, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But like at the same time, it's like, oh, you know, good thing he got away from him. You know, I hope that guy is doing well if he exists.
Right. There's, I think he's a composite of like various people.
Yeah.
But yeah, good for all of those people not being able to get too close to interconnect.
Yeah.
So then we flash back forward to July 1997, the front steps of the Versace house. Antonio hears a shot, comes running out. Darren Criss, as Andrew Kunanen, does this great thing where he just sort of like regards Versace coolly, like having shot him, and then turns around and his face sort of crumples. And then a few seconds after that, he's sort of on the run and has to be kind of menacing with a gun. So there's just like all these emotions that he has to run through so quickly. Quick factual point. Yes. The bullet also hit a dove, which sounds like a crazy thing that would happen. But the whole thing with like the dove getting shot right next to Versace did actually happen. And they did later perform an autopsy on the dove. So that's something
that's wild.
You feel must be invented for the show, but is not.
Wow.
So,
it's like something out of a John Woo movie.
Exactly. It was so John Woo. I was expecting some face-offness there. And here we get to another aspect of the show that's been disputed. We see Ricky Martin as Antonio D'Amico sort of cradling Gianni's body covered in blood and being very upset. And the real Antonio saw some like photographs from the set of that exact scene and objected to it. He's just like, that just didn't happen. Like, I was pulled away. This never happened. And Ricky Martin since reached out to Antonio, was like, please don't judge us based on these photos. Please watch the show. Ricky Martin said at the Television Critics Association press tour last summer that he sort of felt like he had gotten to a slightly better place with Antonio, but I believe Antonio has said that he will not be watching the show, which I can't really blame him for that.
Yeah.
But,
regardless of like quality or anything, and like, no.
No. But this is another bit of poetic license, but one that I don't mind, because then Ricky Martin as Antonio D'Amico spends the rest of the episode covered in Johnny's blood.
It's very Jackie O.
Yeah, it's
Jackie Kennedy.
Yeah, exactly. It's very Jackie. You can't. It's an irresistible image, I think. So, you know, I don't really blame them for going with that. But we see Andrew on the run. We see a man. We see a lot of the beginning of the media circus, which is something we are quite familiar with from watching The People versus O.J. Simpson, right? We see a bystander taking a Polaroid, something that actually happened. He later sold it. You know, like this vulturism that just begins immediately around this death. So, and then we come to the bumbling law enforcement, which is another, you know, as Maureen pointed out, the subtitle of her book is The Biggest Failed Manhunt in U.S. history. So a lot of theme of both this show and her book is the way in which law enforcement really just missed a trick or 20 in trying to pull this whole case together. And so we meet a couple of law enforcement, local law enforcement, and then soon thereafter, local FBI.
Yeah. And in this scene where they're not exactly interrogating, just sort of questioning Antonio, it's another bit of the show setting up a thesis statement about in this case about the law enforcement and how they treated gay people and how in not taking them seriously in any real way, they, you know, hobbled themselves in, you know, they weren't really able to perform their jobs because they weren't really seeing the situation for what it actually was, because they went in with all these pre-things, you know, loaded into their heads.
We haven't seen the finale yet, but I don't think this is something the show covered, but something Maureen's book covered is that this one gay FBI agent, like a former FBI agent, who is homosexual, like offered up his services to the FBI to be basically like a gay consultant.
Yeah.
To be like, you guys don't know what you're doing. Like, you don't know anything about this culture. You are fumbling around and you're making all the wrong moves, and let me help you. And they did actually use him as a consultant. Here we see, somewhat well-meaning. He's not painted Detective Scrimshaw, played by Will Chase of Smash fame. He's not being a jerk necessarily, but he is. But he's not like a completely bigoted Sam Rockwellian cop or something like that. Do you know what I mean?
He's Sam Rockwell in Three Billboards, not Sam Rockwell yes, as
sorry.
Sam Rockwell.
As a human.
Leslie Bibb, you monster. I think it's more that it was just like, that was the tone of the day, right? Like that's, you know, how a lot of people who were otherwise decent just treated this. And granted, he is, you know, it was a little outsized, let's say, you know, he's in this huge mansion and, you know, like the life, that life would be foreign for anybody really, you know, but still, yeah, I think for the most part, what we're seeing is just like, well, that's, you know, he's a cop and in 1997 and that's how people, you know, that's how people were treated. Gay people were treated a lot of the time by, you know, people who weren't, you know, outright bigots.
We're going to talk to Ricky Martin later in the episode, but this performance from him here, like, I didn't know what to expect from Ricky Martin, the actor.
Has he done much acting?
I don't think so. And I was really floored by this. I thought he was really fantastic, especially in the scene, but kind of throughout. And something that I didn't know until, I guess I'm looking now. He's got a few credits to his name. He appeared in Glee.
He was in the movie Idle Hands, which I believe is the Devon Sawa horror movie,
as, playing Man in Car Park uncredited. Yeah.
So he's a seasoned veteran.
So this is a big leap forward for our Ricky Martin. But he, something that I didn't know that I just found out recently is he is really, really good friends with Edgar Ramirez.
Interesting.
They were very close before this, and actually Edgar got the role of Gianni Versace first, and he told Ricky Martin before he told anyone else, because they are indeed that close. And Ryan Murphy says that he didn't know this when he called Ricky in for like a conversation. And he told this story, Ryan Murphy, that like when he auditioned, or he had a dinner with Ricky Martin where he just wanted to offer him the role of Antonio. No audition required. His life is his audition, I guess. And he said that, you know, when Ricky Martin told Edgar, they both were like, oh my God, am I going to be Antonio? Like that was their initial thought. And then during the dinner that Ricky had with Ryan Murphy, Ryan Murphy swears that Ricky Martin was texting Edgar Ramirez under the table being like, oh my God, he offered it to me. Oh my God, I'm going to do it. So, you know, they took this very close, you know, Ryan Murphy, I guess by accident, that's crazy, but by accident stumbled upon these two men who already have just a very close familial bond as friends. And I think it really does, that warmth and comfort with each other, I think really comes through in other episodes. We don't see them together too much in this episode, obviously, at all. But, you know, something that Martin is really playing beautifully, I think. So, and then we have the, you know, Johnny's rushed off to the hospital. We see some stuff with a pawn shop owner played by Kathy Moriarty and all this sort of stuff. But before all of that, or in the midst of all of that, we get the arrival of Donatella and Santa Versace, played by Penelope Cruz and Giovanni Cifiera. And it's shot so beautifully. The camera's up under the plane door as it opens, and like the, you know, the opera is dialed up to 11, and it's just like this, you know, if you had any doubts about how you should feel about the arrival of Donatella Versace here, like the show is here to make it very clear. And
that's throughout. I mean, she's just filmed so grandly, you know, that there are a lot of different shots of her that just are very like, I don't know. I mean, it's a little silly, but I also love it.
Yeah, I mean, but this is how Ryan Murphy shows, at least American Horror Story, often treat their blondes. You know what I mean? Like, this, she is one of many like blondes of the Murphyverse. But you know, so we have Donatello come into this interrogation scene, throw the police out of the house, you know, and we have Antonio saying once again, you know, alluding to but not saying anything about Gianni's illness. And he says, they'll find out, Donatella. She says, what will they find out? He says, everything. And then Donatella goes sort of like immediately into shutdown mode. They have a Versace spokesperson come out and say, like, Versace did not know Cunanan. Like, this is, you know, unrelated to anything. And just trying to sort of circle the wagons around this grand family for reasons. You know, we find out immediately thereafter that they were thinking of listing the business on the New York Stock Exchange. And that's sort of, which they decided not to do, but that was sort of, is presumed to be one of the reasons that the Versaces really closed down the flow of information around this is they were worried about hurting their business. If it came out that Johnny was ill, if indeed he was ill, that would hurt the brand, all that sort of stuff. So that's a thing that once again the episode alludes to but does not overtly state.
Right.
And yeah, so it's
what are we, I mean, I, you know, I know we'll have her, well, no, I shouldn't say that, but, you know, Penelope Cruz is an interesting bit of casting, you know, but I think she's also, in some ways, genius casting, like, and she is really, I think she's really good on this. The accent, I'm not good enough at accents, even though I took many years of Italian, to really say one way or another how right she gets that, but I think she gets the bearing and the presence of Donatella Versace, who after this point became very much a celebrity in her own right. So it's just kind of, I don't know, I think it's Penelope Cruz is at the right kind of spot in her career for this. I think it's great.
Yeah, you know, this is something that we saw with People versus OJ is the I think the very intelligent use of the star actor. You know what I mean? The use of a John Travolta, the use of a Cuba Gooding Jr., something like that. And so, like, when Penelope, like, this is a very good cast. You know, and as the show goes on, we'll see a lot of other faces of really great actors. But I think having the biggest star presence be Penelope Cruz really does do something. The whole tenor of everything changes when she arrives on screen, and that is meant to reflect, I assume, what it's like to be in the presence of Donatella Versace.
And so, I think also importantly, you know, I guess there is some inherent camp to both Donatella Versace as a person and Penelope Cruz in a blonde wig or dyed blonde hair doing this accent, in, you know, like, there is that. But I think also the surprising thing about her so far, her role on the show and the performance, is that she's actually part of she's one of the strongest sort of emotional cores of it, you know, and she's actually a real window or a conduit for the audience into the sort of heart of the story and the tragedy of it. So that's a pleasant surprise. She's not just swanning around with her cigarettes, you know, saying ridiculous things. She actually makes sense in it.
Right, because, I mean, Penelope Cruz is a huge star, but also just an incredible actress,
yeah.
And she's not phoning any of this in. And, you know, the last thing that happens in this episode is following up on the lead from this pawn shop owner. The police bust down the door of a motel room, and are they, you know, have they found Andrew Cunanan? No, they have not. They have found a character named Ronnie, played by Max Greenfield, which is based on a real person. And we'll get a little bit more of him in the next episode. And then we cut to Andrew, now and all, looking very beautiful and put together. And this is once again, like, this feels like a flight of fancy to me. Like, Andrew being, like, sweaty and in denim jeans for the last bits of his life makes more sense to me than Andrew looking, like, beautiful and polished put together. But we, like, he is in all yellow, sees the headlines with, you know, about what he's done, and buys them all. So
yeah, which, you know, of course, is tying back to the beginning of the episode with,
right. So before we get to our interview with Ricky Martin, I wanted to ask you, Richard, just sort of generally what you thought of this first episode as an introduction to the series, if you thought it was a really effective way to kick off the story, you know, with the assassination and go from there, or what you thought of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was lucky enough to be able to, you know, scroll up and press play on episode number 2, and I was eager to do it. You know, I like I said, I think in our introductory episode, I'm not always on the Ryan Murphy train, and I know this isn't exactly his show, but, you know, it is kind of his show too. Because I think sometimes he can go a little overboard with the camp, and it becomes almost kind of cruel. But I think so far the tone feels right. The performances feel right. Chris is a very complicated bit of work, and it's going to get more complicated. So I think we should maybe assess him further down the road. But yeah, I don't know. And I also like little, like, random bits, like Kathy Moriarty popping up as a pawn shop person, and, you know,
me too.
You know, but I also, I think that what this show has to set before it that OJ maybe didn't. There was so much in OJ that had to do specifically with that. Whereas with Versace, it has to, broaden its scope a little bit to kind of fill out 9 episodes. And I think they're doing that smartly so far in the first episode. You know, we're getting a broader emotional map maybe than I thought we would. And I appreciate that. And I think that hopefully if people stick with the show, it might, I don't know, it might kind of enlighten people a bit on certain things, I think specifically pertaining to aspects of the gay experience.
Yeah, and I'm really excited to talk about that with you. We should note that this is the only episode of The Assassination of Gianni Versace that Ryan Murphy directed, versus he directed 4 episodes of People vs. OJ. So, like, you're right that it is a Ryan Murphy show, especially in this episode that's directed by him. But I think it's almost less of a Ryan Murphy show than a lot of his other shows are. That yeah. sort of seems to be the American Crime Story way. So, and yeah, it does feel, I agree with you, it does feel early to give a referendum on Darren Criss, especially like you and I have cheated and watched ahead, so we know like what else there is to come. There's just so much more. But for this introduction, this, I mean, it's kind of astonishing that Edgar Ramirez is Gianni Versace is only alive before the credits in this episode, because I think he makes just such an instant impact. This idea of Gianni as sort of like this unofficial mayor of South Beach, where he walked around and he said hi to everyone and he was like so lovely and gregarious. And I just think you immediately get that with like 4 lines of dialogue. And I love Edgar Ramirez in this role, and I agree with everything we said about Penelope Cruz as well. So, and Ricky Martin. So excited to see how this all goes. Let us go now to our interview with Ricky Martin.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
At eBay, you'll always get that feel of real, because your fashion purchase will be backed by authenticity guarantee. Whether it's a knit bag, a must-have watch, dreamy jewelry, or fire sneakers and fresh streetwear, every step will feel authentic, every flex will feel real. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal with eBay Authenticity Guarantee. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Joining us today is singing sensation and star of American Crime Story, The Assassination of Gianni Versace, Ricky Martin. Ricky, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm good. I wanted to kick off by asking you about, I was so blown away by your performance in this first episode, especially. So much of what you do or have done in your career, be it at Vegas or Broadway or world tours, have been these sort of big, loud performances. But one of my favorite scenes in this episode is just this moment where you're staring sort of silently in the mirror at yourself. And I was wondering what the challenges, were of going so much more interior and quieter for this show than some of the things you've done in the past.
It's incredible, because that scene wasn't even on the script. And that day we spent, I would say, at least 8 or 9 hours shooting number one, the when my character actually finds the body of his pretty much husband on the street.
Yeah.
After that, we went to a really, really deep investigation. I mean, we shot the scene where the FBI is, you know, pretty much investigating me, finding, you know, trying to find out that I was not the killer.
Right.
And then it was so emotional, you know, the whole day was so emotional, was so draining that at the end of the day, I guess Ryan wanted to use and take advantage of that vulnerability. And he goes, Rick, come on, let's go to the bathroom. I want you to stand in front of the mirror, wash your hands because you've been covered in blood for the last 10 hours. And tell me and give me whatever you can in front of the mirror. And it was very simple. It was all one shot. And I was just exhausted. I was draining. I was really sad. It took me a minute to disconnect.
Yeah.
From, you know, the amount of emotions that I had to deal with that day. But, it's not methodical, but it was. I was living as Antonio D'Amico for at least 2 weeks while I was living in that house. And we were living in this house. I'm talking about the villa, the Italian villa in Miami Beach, Gianni's house. And it was really intense, but I'm glad you enjoy that moment.
Well, yeah, sorry it came at a personal emotional cost to you, but it made for really good television.
No. I mean, it's all connected. I was exhausted because of how long and how emotional the scenes that I shot that day were.
Well, you know, speaking of that, the scene that comes before it, that interrogation scene, did that kick up anything for you personally when you're having to confront this, I don't know, ignorance about what it means to be in a loving, committed gay relationship? Was that challenging for you to perform?
Well, you know, we're talking about the 90s, and now things are a bit more open and more flexible and more fluid when it comes to relationships. Back in the day, the fact that you were open to bring someone into your relationship was something that was people weren't used to it. So obviously, the character of the FBI agent is asking, "But I don't understand. Were you his boyfriend? Were you his husband? Were you his pimp? What were you?" So it's I understand the confusion of the character. But at the same time, I'm shedding some light to love. I'm shedding some light to how can you, it's been 15 years. My relationship, I'm talking as Antonio, with Gianni lasted 15 years. We protected each other. We loved each other. It was very intrusive. And then on top of that, after that scene, Penelope, as in Donatella, comes in and then she beats me up even harder.
Right.
So it was very, very touchy. I was really confused. I wouldn't know how to react in a situation like this. So it came across, and I'm very pleased with my job. I'm very pleased because Ryan Murphy was very happy, and apparently the critics as well. So I'm celebrating, to be honest.
Good. You deserve it. I've loved listening to you talk about how you had this pre-existing close relationship with Edgar Ramirez, who plays Johnny Versace.
He's my brother.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that really, you know, viewers haven't seen all of the other episodes, but we know that the show goes back in time, so we will see more of Gianni and Antonio together. And you guys just have this very easy chemistry together. It's very close intimacy that it takes some TV couples like seasons to develop, and you guys just have it immediately. Can you talk about what it was like working with Edgar and how that helped you develop that relationship on screen?
I think it's all about being vulnerable and available for the needs of your colleague and vice versa. And we clicked. We studied together. We did a little bit of research together, and I would share with him where I was and what my, you know, preceding circumstances emotionally were and vice versa. But we had a great time. I think, you know, it's like Edgar, before, the most important thing is for us to have a great time and for us to feel comfortable with each other, not afraid. I'm not here to judge you. I know that you don't judge me. Let's just let these emotions flow. And I'm going to tell you something. The same thing happened with Penelope. I've known Penelope for many years. And the fact that I was able to, you know, be in front of a camera was there was bliss. But because of the camaraderie, the level of communication, and when she was not or I was not comfortable with something, we would exchange ideas in order for this to make it a win-win situation, you know, not only for the show, but for us and actors. You did an amazing job. And it's been one day Edgar told us, I think we must have done something good for us to be doing a project like this, because not only the opportunity of exposure that we get, but also the energy on set was always on point.
You talked about research that you and Edgar did together. I read the Maury North book, and there's a lot about, obviously, so much about Andrew, something about the Versaces, but very little Antonio. So I'm wondering, sort of outside of the script you got from Tom Rob Smith, like what research you did to discover Antonio as a character.
I talked to Antonio personally. We found him. I found him. And I said, Antonio, this is what I'm working on. He's like, yeah, Ricky, I know. And he said, the only problem that I have is that paparazzi shot that I saw with you wearing a green shirt. Ricky, I never wear green shirts. it was adorable. And then I explained to him, Antonio, we're not doing a photo of the events. Mm-hmm. We're just doing a painting. And with a painting, you can add colors and get rid of colors. And I am so thankful that we are talking, because at the end of the day, all I want to do is do justice to the love that you and Gianni had. So in order for that to happen, I'm just going to ask you some really heavy questions. I'm sorry that I'm doing this. And I know that it must have been incredibly difficult for him to relive everything after 20 years. So, but still, you know, he was very generous, very open. He was specific about things that he lived with Gianni. And their relationship, and how he felt when all this happened, and how he felt after all this happened. And I brought everything to set with me. So everything that you see is based on the communication that I've had directly with Antonio D'Amico.
I know that, you know, Antonio had some concerns. You had this conversation with him where it seemed like you sort of communicated exactly what you say, that this is all being done in the interest of honoring the legacy of Versace and Antonio and all of that. Knowing that and having heard all of you guys talk about that, that's what you want to do. What does it feel like then when the Versace family is so vocally resistant to this even existing?
At the same time, Donatella sent Penelope the day of the premiere an arrangement of flowers.
Right.
So it's one of those things. We're going by a book. We're going by a book written by Maureen Orth, and it's an investigational book, and it's very serious stuff that actually happened because of really, really intense investigation and years of investigation that she went through. But at the end of the day, this series doesn't talk bad about anyone. It's just, we focus really on the psyche of the actual killer. And we are not attacking. I don't want to use that term, but we are bringing some light into the fact that it's not how Gianni Versace died, it's why we allowed it to happen. Andrew Cunanan was on the list of the FBI most wanted, and he was not hiding, and no one found him. You know, there is homophobia in this. And at the end of the day, I mean, if you have a gay man killing gay men in the 90s, it was one of those things of look the other way. They're doing it for they're doing it for themselves. And that's actually why I said I definitely want to be part of this, because this people need to know this, and we need to stop the hate. That's pretty much it.
One of the more interesting themes of the season that I think the show explores is sort of the damage that the closet, being in the closet, can do, both on Cunanan and all of the people around him. I was wondering...
And Gianni himself.
And I was wondering, you know, given your own journey with your sexuality through the 90s and then coming out and being, you know, by your own words, a just much happier person when that happened, I was wondering what it was like to dive back into this world of closeted 90s reaction to homosexuality.
Yeah. Well, just like me, Johnny suffered from a little bit of internalized homophobia, and the people around him, just like me, people that really loved him, told him, you cannot do this. If you come out, this will be the end of your career. Imagine,
right.
Gianni Versace, a fashion icon. Are you? I cannot believe. And the sad thing is that still today, there's a lot of people that are struggling with this. I went through it. It's the most uncomfortable and I would say probably saddest times of my life, where I thought that my life, my emotions were evil, because that's what they told me. You're not supposed to feel like this. But luckily, Gianni, and we talk about this in the series, he was able to come out. He did an interview with Antonio D'Amico next to him, and did anything happen to his life? No. I came out, and did something happen to my career? No. So it's also something that is very important that we touch in this series. And yeah, the no one knows how easy it is to come out until you actually do it.
I know you lived in Miami. I know you never met Versace, but you lived in Miami sort of right around the time when he was holding court there, having all these parties. What did seeing someone like that, an icon like Versace, out in Miami, what did that mean to you during the time that you lived down there?
You know, I didn't know he was out. I never met him. Mm-hmm. I was invited to this to the house many, many times, but I had a Giorgio Armani campaign at the time, so I competition. You can't go there. But anyways, obviously, just like now, if someone that has power comes out, he or she will be talking on behalf or serving as an example for those men and women that are struggling. I'm not even talking about young men and women. I'm talking about men and women from all ages. And Harvey Milk said it, everybody, please, let's normalize it. He needs to come out. And because there is absolutely nothing wrong with love. So even though at that time it didn't do anything to me, on the contrary, I was so locked in a closet. But eventually when I did it, the amount of love that I received on social media by people saying, thank you so much, because of you, I understand myself better. Because of you, my father understands me. Because of you, I understand my uncle, who's a gay man. So it's a domino effect proposed by love.
One of my favorite things that I've heard you talk about in your interviews in the past has been your relationship with like ambition and fame. You started when you were, what, 7 or 8, I think. And, you've been in the spotlight ever since. And I was wondering, you've used the word addiction a couple times to describe sort of your passion for the work that you do. Andrew Cannon was obviously driven by a much darker ambition for the spotlight, for notoriety. But is there any part of you at all that identifies or understands sort of what Darren Criss is doing with Andrew Cannon and this like seductive desire for attention?
I cannot talk for Darren. I cannot talk for much less for Andrew.
Right.
All I know is that since I was a little boy, when I was 5 years old, I was doing plays in school. And then the first time that I did that I was in front of a camera, I think I was 8 or 9, and I was doing TV commercials. And there was a little shot of adrenaline that kept me going. And then when I was 12, that I was able to perform in front of a crowd, and you felt that energy coming from people in front of you telling you you're doing a good job, I said, oh my God, this is it. I'm hooked. I've found myself. This is what I need. And I don't know if this is answering your question, but it is. It is very powerful. I'm very lucky that I found my path at such a young age. And I hope I can keep doing this until the day I die.
I know that Darren went back to shoot a little bit more after the premiere you guys had last Monday. Were you done shooting, or did you go?
Me too.
Oh, you did too. Okay. So, yeah. So my question is, you know, getting to go to the premiere, seeing everyone sort of react so positively to the premiere and your performance in the premiere, does that change at all when you go back then to shoot the finale? Does that change, I don't know, your confidence level in performing or anything about how you approach the work, having seen this early positive feedback?
It is. It does. It does. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how tough you try to be. I'm sorry, but you know, you do this and you love it when people come and, you know, and they tell you the media, the fans through social media, they tell you, you did a good job. Yes, of course, when you walk on set after you hear people saying that you did a good job, for sure, you feel pumped and you feel inspired, motivated. But the truth is that I have been studying the scenes that I have to shoot after the premiere with Penelope for months. And regardless of what people thought, I was just starving for those scenes because they were incredibly important. There were scenes that are part of the final episode. And they're life. These scenes were life-changing. I really hope you enjoy them.
Now that you've done this, gotten a taste for what it's like to do this kind of project with Ryan, what would you like to do next acting-wise?
This is exactly what I wished for a few years ago. And look at this opportunity that came to me. So I'm just going to leave it like that. Obviously, I just want to push buttons. I need to push buttons. And I need to be part of a really heavy story. Am I describing Versace right now? But this is the kind of project that I want to be part of for sure. I mean, serious stuff, and I don't know, maybe go back in time and portray specific people that impacted society. I'm reading lots of books. I'm looking for something that maybe I can not only act, but I can also produce it and be part of the whole beginning or even script writing.
Excellent. Well, I can't wait to see what that is, and I can't wait to see the finale. And thank you again so much for your time, Ed.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye. All the best.
This episode was engineered by Danielle Roth and produced by Dave Gonzalez. Thank you so much for joining us for this premiere. Look at the premiere. We're so excited to go on this journey with you. Until next time, Richard, where can people find your work?
On VanityFair.com and on Twitter at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And I'm Joanna Robinson. You can find me also on VanityFair.com where we will have wall-to-wall Versace coverage. And you can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. Feel free to tweet at us if you have questions about the show that you want answered on the podcast. We will do our best. And until then, we will see you next time.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.